Paper 11, section 6, which is old single column, page 123. So we must be moving right along, I guess, based upon that numerology. But actually, we're not. We're going to do one little retrogression. Before we, you know, we get into space respiration here, for those who are interested in reflecting on some of the little more advanced issues in play, remember how when we started up the previous section last time that we were talking about different ways that you can understand the differential, you know, or the difference, the separation, the distinction that is literally embodied in the thickness of the Isle of Paradise. That you have that basic individuality viewpoint, separation between the unqualified absolute and the deity absolute, you know, that's made Isle. It's made the thickness of the Isle. You also have, from you know, the unity viewpoint, thinking about that differentiation between of total deity, capital T, that differentiation of total deity into the infinitude and the infinity, into space and motion, and how they were alluding to that sort of between the lines of that little paragraph roughly, you know, and then talking about space and time relative to the Isle. Then we also were talking about, you know, just letting it sink in, the recognition that you have this mysterious, in many ways, adjective, paradise, that's attached to, you know, the word Isle, as the paradise Isle, but also attached to the word Trinity, the paradise Trinity, and that paradiseness, you know, as mysterious as that concept really is, just noticing that those two facts share that characteristic in common. They both embody this aspect that you conceive of as initially being in that infinite suitcase of the I am, you know, and it gets unpacked into all the different facets of reality, that those two facts have that, linkage back to the whole in common. They both share something called paradise likeness, you know, or paradiseness, if you want to be, you know, really direct. It's literally paradise. And so in many ways, you know, you just recognizing that, you know that they have to be together in some very intimate way. They must share a space in a, you know, in infinity to some degree. And so thinking about that, we were talking about the deity presence up in the center of the upper surface. And now we have this series of shells of presence of Universal Father, encompassed by the Eternal Son, encompassed by the Infinite Spirit, encompassed by the functioning of the Paradise Trinity. But the Paradise Trinity itself, not its functioning, not its expression, in that functional mode, but just the fact of it, just allowing the easy sort of visualization of thinking of that as really being co-present with the Isle. You know, actually in that inaccessible interior of the Isle, that within lies paradiseness, you know, which is just a thing apart from everything else. And the two share this space, as it were, in infinity. And then down in the center of on the nether side, you have that expression of, you know, of a central point to the Paradise Trinity, the co-infinite one, and then all of, you know, talking about what goes on in nether paradise. But, you know, again, just backing up. So, you know, in the unity viewpoint, you have a facet of deity called the universal one of infinity. And it's a very special facet of deity, and then it very definitively, very fundamentally has two sides to it. One side being the first center, and the other side being the Paradise Trinity. And we've used an analogy a number of times to think about those two sides, where, and let me do it the other way, you know, opposite way than I normally do it here. If you think of it, the universal one of infinity is a big disk, you know, an infinite radius disk. But only one side is flat, and the other side is one massive peak. Okay, you know, one central peak with infinite slopes. Okay, you have this analogy you're picturing like this. Okay. So put it like that, okay? So that first center, that peak side, that center-like side, okay, is that dome, you know, really the core of that dome of the deity presence, okay? And then here's the slab of the aisle, see? The Paradise Trinity, you know, another way to thinking about why it is that you know, that you're this there's this tendency in play, you know, for the first center to wanting to be to ball everything up into God the Infinite, you know, and that's why it's drawn out like that. It's wanting to grab a hold of infinity and just encompass the whole thing and make this singular fact of God the Infinite, and there's no room for anyone else. But it can't do that. Just like I can't bend my hand back, you know, the other direction. I mean, the immutability of the aisle, the unbendability, the unbreakability, you know, the infinite, you know, tensile strength of the aisle, you know, is just a sort of a direct expression again of that understanding of the difference between the first center and the Paradise Trinity, in the universal one of infinity. You know, the aisle is not going to bend, and neither is the Paradise Trinity that sort of cohabitates, you know, the paradise space in infinity. Mm-hmm. So that vertical thickness of the aisle, see, has a lot of potential of to sort of directly visualize and understand various parts of the picture. Okay, you know, not just in regard, like we talked about last time, like I said, you know, this sort of in the beginning stories where you have some sort of separation going on, but an ongoing differential between the first center and the Paradise Trinity as the two sides of the universal one of infinity. Okay, so you're going to see is just right away when we start reading here, they're going to bring up that hourglass analogy for the space directly that we brought up in advance, kind of, you know, because I knew this was, you know, coming up, so we kind of previewed that picture, and you know, we'll talk about that a little bit again, so we can again appreciate why they introduced that analogy. And it's just like I was just doing. The whole point is as many analogies as you can come up with that you can rigorously put to the test, and they withstand all attempts to refute them. You know, this embodies a measure of the truth. I can anchor my understanding with this analogy, and at least in an area that I have to sort of determine experientially where the limits of the analogy are, but there's going to be some definitive space where I can really directly understand things with a nice solid analogy. I mean, the relators encourage it a lot, and we've been trying to take that suggestion and build more, as many solid analogies as we can, because until you can literally picture it, and see the relationships geometrically and stuff, you just can't understand. You have to take it out of the abstract space. It needs to be something that you can really, get your mind around visually in front of you, before you can really achieve understanding. Okay, so let's pick up the rest of the story. Remember, we in the previous section, we talked about the expansion and contraction of the force charge of space, and that it was synchronized. Here you're really very literally using the word synchronized in terms of the temporal association with the other half of the story. The space that force charge is pervading is also respirating, is also expanding and contracting.
Section 6, space respiration. We do not know the actual mechanism of space respiration. We merely observe that all space alternately contracts and expands. This respiration affects both the horizontal extension of pervaded space and the vertical extensions of unpervaded space, which exist in the vast space reservoirs above and below paradise. In attempting to imagine the volume outlines of these space reservoirs, you might think of an hourglass.
No way. Okay. So, remember I tried to point out, it's very likely that when you've read this in the past, you sort of just skipped over. It's like, okay, so it's just another way of talking about the Maltese cross analogy. But it's a fundamentally different analogy. This analogy doesn't allow you to directly picture the midspace zones totally, surrounding paradise and extending out, without any breaks. But this analogy is very useful for what they're just about to use it for in the next paragraph. Okay. So in this analogy, you literally picture this hourglass, where the upper domain of the hourglass is the upper reservoir of unpervaded space, and the lower domain of the hourglass is the lower reservoir of unpervaded space, and they have bottoms and tops on them. They don't go to infinity. Just like an hourglass has a bottom and a top. Okay. And then in the neck of the hourglass, just add one little additional image to this. Right in the middle of the neck, floating in the middle, not touching the sides of the hourglass, is a little bubble. Imagine a little spherical bubble of midspace. Okay, in the center of that neck of the hourglass. So it's all surrounded, that little sphere of midspace is surrounded, in the neck of the hourglass by unpervaded space. And at the center of the bubble, horizontally like this, is the Isle of Paradise. So that's the picture. Okay. And then, let me just say it right now so you see when we read the next paragraph. So then the horizontal space, all the way around, the equator of this hourglass, the neck of the hourglass in the plane here, extending out in every direction, all the way around me, flaring out as far as the eye can see in every direction, is pervaded space, coming in towards the hourglass from every side, getting thinner, until it's just a thin little slab in the center. Okay. And that pervaded space cuts through the neck of the hourglass, right below the aisle, below the little bubble floating in there. Okay, so there's this little region that's both within the walls of the hourglass and then within this slab of pervaded space as it comes in right to the center, Okay, where the, you know, where the two, you know, where this pervaded space cuts through the neck of the hourglass, just below the aisle. Okay, so that's the analogy here. A little bit different than the Maltese cross analogy, because you know, they want to actually have a location that you can directly think about where the two spaces overlap, pervaded and unpervaded space, occupy the same domain, the same region.
Okay. It's interesting that they place horizontal space as coming in at the very top of the Nether Paradise section, to me.
Right. And the reason for visualizing it as cutting through the neck of the hourglass right below Paradise rather than above, mm-hmm. is you really want to think of the infinite capacity, the unqualified absolute, and the space potency of that presence, you know, as being anchored on Nether Paradise as a non-personal fact, you know. And so you want this dynamic region, as we're about to read, where the two occupy the same volume in this analogy, okay, to be near that source point of Nether Paradise, you know, and in a sense, also as far away from Upper Paradise as possible, as non-personal as possible.
But still close to the neck.
Right, right. Okay, still close to this, you know, the Paradise source and center. Okay, but the non-personal side of the Paradise source and center. Okay.
As the universe's of the horizontal extension of pervaded space expand, the reservoirs of the vertical extension of unpervaded space contract and vice versa. There is a confluence of pervaded and unpervaded space just underneath Nether Paradise. Both types of space there flow through the transmuting regulation channels, where changes are wrought, making pervadable space non-pervadable, and vice versa in the contraction and expansion cycles of the cosmos.
Okay. So, now, notice they use the word flow, just like we were doing when we were going through the Nether Paradise section last week. I mean, the easiest way to start to think about what they're describing there is to visualize flows of various sorts. Where pervaded and unpervaded space are together, you have a confluence. That literally means together flowing. You know, to flow, they flow together there. Okay. So they're totally, you know, intermeshed here, and so they intimately can be transmuted one to the other. Now, normally, when we're just kind of thinking about the basics of energy, when we think of this confluence region, we think of this as being, as they describe it, this transmuting regulation channels. This region is where the primary transcendental master force organizers, okay, where those primary force organizers have a presence, an active presence, that like in the state we are in right now, where pervaded space is expanding and reservoir space is contracting. So you have unpervaded space coming in and pervaded space going out of that confluence region. And so their dynamic, you know, active presence in that confluence region, we think of as taking space potency coming in and evolving it, you know, as it were, you know, morphing it, transmuting it one notch towards the power by taking that space potency and turning it into primordial force, the force charge of space, of pervaded space. So you just think of that transmutation in that simple way, of space potency coming in and primordial force coming out. Here they're, and you'll see it in the next paragraph two, they're reminding you it's a little bit more complicated than that. Okay, notice the way they word it. They don't use the expressions pervaded and unpervaded there. They used something slightly different. They said making pervadable space unpervadable and vice versa. Oh, you're going, so we're not even talking about the force charge here. I mean, yes, that happens, what we described, but there's another thing going on that's more fundamental than that. Okay. In other words, there's this space potency notion, this idea of what's antecedent to the force, to the primordial force. This idea of, in some way of thinking of there being a presence of the unqualified absolute, which is the reservoir of potential, to make matter, and that's what we're thinking about, this whole process of making matter, going from force to energy to power, actual matter. Okay, so we're drawing that actuality out of the reservoir of potential. So we're thinking of this potential as being a presence, the presence of the unqualified absolute, the space potency. Okay, but they're saying, okay, it's not the same everywhere. There's a transmutation that's occurring here. Okay, you're not just taking space potency in and no space potency comes out, just force charge comes out. Yes, force charge comes out, but also a changed space potency comes out. Okay, the space potency is everywhere, not just in the reservoir space.
They labeled it pervadability.
Right, so you have a space potency in the reservoir space that's non-pervadable, not pervadable, can't be have any augmentation to it like the force charge pervading, co-pervading that domain. Okay. But the space potency that's in the universe space, in the horizontal space here, is pervadable, can have an augmentation added to it. So what's the difference there? Okay. In the reservoir space, this potential, this space potency, that space potency is directed unto itself. The primary force organizers transmute that so that what leaves is not directed back onto itself, It's directed towards the finite so that you can follow that direction from force through energy to power in the finite. Okay? They're unwrapping it. They're taking a static potential and they're turning it into an activated potential.
Paradise is static.
Yeah, and so is this space potency in non-pervadable space. Okay, that potential of the presence of the unqualified absolute is not activated there. Before you can actually actualize that potential, you have to activate it. You have to sort of, take the lid off of it, in a sense. You need to unwrap it. Okay. Remember when I say, is directed unto itself, I have this closed loop, unqualified absolute. From the unity viewpoint, what facet of deity is that? For those of you who are, the infinite capacity. For those of you who are aware of the, this higher understanding of things that we've been working on. Okay? The relationship of element two to itself, the relationship of the infinitude to itself. Okay? Okay? You're unleashing that. You're opening that closed loop up. Okay, by this non-pervadable space potency, as it were, passing through the presence of the primary force organizers, they snip the loop and open it up, and out can roll the potential to full actualization. Okay? So that's kind of the next notch up of detail in noticing that there's this they're not just changing space potency into the force charge, into primordial force. They're also, before they can do that, they have to activate the potential. And so in their wake is activated potential and the first expression of the actualization of that potential, the beginning of a whole series of an actualization that slowly downsteps and crystallizes into the finite as automatons. Okay, let's read the next one here.
Unpervaded space means unpervaded by those forces, energies, powers, and presences known to exist in pervaded space. We do not know whether vertical reservoir space is destined always to function as the equipoise of horizontal universe space. We do not know whether there is a creative intent concerning unpervaded space. We really know very little about the space reservoirs, merely that they exist and that they seem to counterbalance the space expansion-contraction cycles of the universe of universes.
There's lots of mystery here, but don't let that...
You still consider it, though. Go through the loop three times, right. So it's like they're not just backing away from it.
Right, and don't you either. John knows that that's what I was about to say. Go at this as much as you can and unpack it as much as you can. Get yourself to the limits of what they know. It's like, wow, that seems... They've given you a revelation. They've given you lots of help to move along towards... what they know. And if they don't know a lot, you don't have a very far journey. So, you can make these basic little steps that they've made, and then we're both done, okay? We both know as much as we can know, okay? But notice how it starts out. Again, when we talk about pervaded space, most fundamentally, we think, well, it's pervaded by the force charge. It's charged with primordial force. And then, of course, there's the energies and the powers, too, that are galaxies and whatnot are all over the place, pervaded space. See, but notice there's a fourth thing. It's not just forces, energies, and powers, and presences. The space potency is there, too. The presence of the unqualified absolute is in pervaded space. This activated potential pervades pervaded space as well. And notice what they threw in there, okay? So what are they, they give you a way to talk about the distinction between this static potential and this activated potential. What's been added, basically? In both cases, you have an extent, or reservoir space extends up and down from paradise. Horizontal space extends out from paradise. There's extent in both of them. See, we do not know whether there is creative intent, however, concerning reservoir space. See, you have this closed static potential. You roll it out. You snip it and roll out the loop so it doesn't just feed back on itself. So it isn't just a self-satisfying phenomenon. You give it intent. The infinite capacity is I am that which extends. What's I am that which intends?
Infinite potential.
Upper surface of paradise has entered into the game here. And of course, the moment you have any relationship between those two, the infinite uphold or the universal absolute is in play too. In other words, the whole, things are rolling now. Okay. Yeah. Intent has been added to extent. You know, and they don't know if there's ever going to be any intent associated with that reservoir space. Is it just going to be extent? Or is it ever going to be causatively impregnated, you know, with intent?
Could it be a part of that static aspect of the first functional level of total deity?
Or it could be part of the next universe age. I mean, no one has any, you know, they, no one, because remember, the whole geometry of everything changes once the grand universe is settled in light and life.
They're not taking it
off the table. Yeah, there's no, you know, no one has any idea what that could mean. I mean, the whole structure could change. Okay? You know, you're trans, you're transcending. You know, you've used up all of the potential in this geometry. I mean, we shouldn't be surprised at all if, when the grand universe is settled in light, if the whole master universe geometry changes, so that there's the space in which that absonite potential can be actualized. So, no one knows. Yeah.
Isn't the Earth approximately 4 billion years old?
Well, yeah. Well, how about the Arantia book? That would be a better source of information.
Okay. Yeah. But there's been two respirations then, because it's 2 billion-year cycles.
Right.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, and just note, we'll get to something along that lines in a little bit here. You know, that whole bit about 2 billion, you know, it's not a very long cycle, okay? And so that could possibly really distort the picture about how old everything is. All right. So, you know, right now, though, it's just this equipoise, this counterbalance, you know, space, like they're saying there. All right.
The cycles of space respiration extend in each phase for a little more than 1 billion Urantia years. During one phase, the universes expand. During the next, they contract. Pervaded space is now approaching the midpoint of the expanding phase, while unpervaded space nears the midpoint of the contracting phase, and we are informed that the outermost limits of both space extensions are, theoretically, now approximately equidistant from paradise. The unpervaded space reservoirs now extend vertically above upper paradise and below nether paradise, just as far as the pervaded space of the universe extends horizontally outward from peripheral paradise to and even beyond the fourth outer space level. For 1 billion years of Urantia time, the space reservoirs contract, while the master universe and the force activities of all horizontal space expand. It thus requires a little over 2 billion Urantia years to complete the entire expansion-contraction cycle.
Okay. Now, there's an amazing little phrase in that second to last paragraph that just in one, in what? Let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 words. Solves a mystery, you know, that scientists are currently wrestling with, that has produced vast tracts of, you know, drivel, trying to rationalize something. Okay. It's really, you know, there's nothing to figure out. It's all just very trivial. Okay. And that's okay. So we have this 2 billion-year cycle. 2 billion years. 2 billion years. You know, and just keep going through the cycle. You know, to get from, you know, this is a billion and then another billion, you know, to get back to where you started. And it's 2 billion-year cycle. You know, as you can literally picture, just like we often do, you know, as a sinusoidal, you know, movement, you know, that's oscillating in front of you here. You know, it's totally contracted, now it's totally expanded, now it's back to totally contracted again. You know, and remember, it's a respiration. It has an equilibrium size, and it's oscillating in size about that equilibrium. It's not going all the way to zero and then to some big number, okay? Okay. It's just respirating about an equilibrium size. And this is going like this too, yeah. Okay? Yeah. Right, yeah, there, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay.
You could almost call that the breath of God.
Make a video.
Exactly. I mean, okay, so let's just deal with the let's deal with the spiritual consciousness up front. Okay? Our God is a living God. You know, declares the ancient religionist. This is true. Our God is a living God. His body breathes. His heart pumps. Okay? Remember we just used the heart analogy in the previous section talking about the aisle? Here we use the lung analogy talking about space. Okay? I mean, because our God is a living God. God is an innately dynamic fact. It should be a very simple analogy to use the basic dynamics of our living body to analogize the big picture of God's domain. And it's just right there. I mean, it's trivial. Lungs and heart. Okay?
The universe is organic.
Okay. So, yeah. So that's, you see that, your spiritual consciousness delights in seeing that, you know, that beautiful connection to you as a is a living, breathing, blood-pumping fact. Okay. Now the details, though. When you get into studying the details with telescopes and theories. Okay. Speaking of theories, did you notice outermost limits of both space extensions are theoretically... Now, approximately, it's not like anyone you know, that they know of has gone out there and actually looked. Okay, but theoretically, okay,
they're just doing it by time.
Yeah, well, yeah, right. I mean, no one is, you know.
Anybody surveyed?
I mean, it's not even likely that a solitary messenger has ever gone out there or anything. You know, but this basic issue, you have this cycle, this 2 billion year cycle. So we picture it like a sine wave. Okay? Okay, and what do they tell us about where we are in that cycle? They say, a while back, you were at fully contracted, then you started expanding, you know, and you're right about at the midway point, you know, and now you'll be moving into this stage where it starts to, you know, slow down and reach its maximum size. Okay? So, if that's the facts, if that's actually the universe we live in, a universe that in the immediate past, was as small as it gets and then is accelerating up to speed and then it'll be slowing down, you know, and coming to full size. You know, if we're in a mode where we've just been accelerating up to full speed, as it were, here, okay, quote unquote, we're right at the midpoint there. On a sine curve, okay, if you look at that mathematically, at that halfway point up the slope, it's you know, right in that very center point, it's a dead straight line. You know, it's concave up, then it goes stick straight, and then it's concave down, okay, up to the top. Okay? It's like a straight line. Exactly, like a straight line, right there at that center point. Okay, so if that's where we are in the cycle, if you were in the mode that current science is in, where they have the notion that space is a substance that can be curved, okay, and they apply this theory, this worldview, you know, this initial assumption, to understanding what they observe about the galaxies. Okay, if you assume that this basic expansion that we observe can be modeled, can be understood with curved space-time and general relativity, okay, in that model, you have three possibilities for the shape of the curvature of space. Space could be closed curvature, which means, you know, you imagine this big bang, you know, so you start with nothing and it's expanding outward. And if space is a closed geometry, it means there's enough mass here where, even though the Big Bang was a big bang, you know, in their model, eventually mass is going to go, no, I don't think so. You know, it's going to bring it to a halt and pull it back again. Okay? It's a closed phenomenon. Okay? Or it could be that there isn't enough mass to, you know, to pull it back. And it just, you know, will keep flying out forever. Or it could be, you know, right in exactly in between the two. So, you know, it when you plot the galaxies as a function of distance on the x-axis and a function of apparent velocity of recession in this expansion that you see on the y-axis, you could either, as you get farther out, you could either have a curve that starts to roll over if it's closed, or flare up if it's open, or just stick straight like it is a straight line, the Hubble, you know, constants, the slope of that line. It could just stick straight. Well, you know, as they started being able to put dots on the graph farther out where they knew they could begin to tell if space was open or closed, you know, again, under the assumption of general relativity, you know, they were expecting, of course, to see either, you know, it rolling down over or flaring up. Because it's, you know, I mean, there's an unlimited number of possibilities there on either side, and only one possibility many. It's like a zero probability that everything is just exactly balanced. So, you know, they knew they would find it either closed or open. So they keep plotting. It just kept going stick straight. And they went, whoa, this is bizarre. Why on earth would it be like the zero probability thing of it being a flat space-time? Well, here's something that would look like open space. Here's something that would look like closed space. And right in the middle where we are right now would look like flat space. Okay. Well, they don't know that. They don't know it's just a coincidence that we're basically in the middle of the process here of expanding. So it's flat-like. And so they proceeded to create a vast, elaborate scheme called inflationary cosmology, where you take the basic Big Bang model and you add all these additional knobs to it to rationalize the flatness. Yeah. And, you know, it's very complicated and endlessly epicycled, you know, to make everything fit. Okay, well, all that is just drivel. Okay. I mean, first of all, there is no curved space-time, you know, and all that, you know, just, you know, there is no Big Bang, and but, you know, there is no, it's just a coincidence that we're in the, if you think of space literally, it will seem like it's flat here. Okay?
Yeah. Are these models that they're developing, it seems like from the way you're describing them, they can be so beautiful to the developers that they can just, you know, almost be, you know, in love with these epicycle models that they're creating.
Well, sure, yeah. I mean, this is all elaborately mathematically cool, okay?
Yeah.
And it fosters, you know, I'm one of the six people on the planet that's smart enough to actually understand all this stuff and, you know, and that. Okay. But, you know, okay, all of that is you can just forget about all that. All of that means nothing. Okay. It's just that we're coincidentally where the sine curve, you know, is like a straight line. Okay. Now, immediately in the past, what were things like? They were in the mode where we were starting at the bottom and going up, where things were accelerating. Okay? You were in the acceleration phase, not the deceleration phase that will follow here, but you were in the acceleration phase. Well, as they continued to look with their now rationalized Big Bang with the inflationary model added to it, they started to notice that there appeared to be acceleration two that we've been undergoing. It's like, oh, well, we got to add another knob. We got to have another magical thing that we add to our model to rationalize why the universe's expansion is accelerating like this. Okay? Okay, and that's the biggie. That's when it reaches the, you know, the pinnacle of absurdity. That's dark energy. Okay? Okay? The whole notion that now that it that dominates, you know, the worldview of physics and everything else, you know, is being forced to fall in line with this, is that the universe is ruled by dark energy. It's all just drivels you again. Okay, there is no dark energy. There is nothing, no magical thing that you have to invent to try to somehow explain this acceleration. Every 2 billion years, it does that. Okay, it's just because it respirates. And coincidentally, we're just passing out of the acceleration phase. And, you know, and our, you know, that's all there is to it. None of that stuff means anything. All that inflationary cosmology, all that dark energy, it's all just make-believe.
1 billion years, heart, that's pretty darn quick breathing.
Yeah.
That is good.
Right, right. It's, you know, remember, yeah, and like Robert was bringing up, you know, the very fact that this cycle is only 2 billion years, obviously, if you're rationalizing from backwards, you know, and, you know, and it's like, well, okay, you know, you say, well, if it, you know, they don't know that it actually, you know, has a bottom point. You know, they extrapolate it all the way back to zero, you know. But, of course, it's going to be the same kind of order of magnitude. So instead of, you know, on the order of 1 billion, it's going to be a little bit bigger. You know, what are they, you know, they come up with 13.75 billion, you know, for the Big Bang. Yeah. You know? Okay. See, but actually, that's three orders of magnitude. I mean, the scale of time over which things have been happening is trillions of years, not billions of years. Okay. That's the actual kind of basic time scale of, you know, of things happening in terms of galaxies and stuff. You know, trillion is the fundamental unit that you play with. You know, ages of stars, trillions, not billions. You know, ages of galaxies, trillions, not billions. Okay, okay. So, you know, on that scale, I mean, 1/1000th of that. Yeah, it's a pretty quick respiration. You know,
are there any scientists that are also reading like the Bible and, you know, putting two and two together and saying, well, wait a minute, maybe this is, you know, God-breathed?
Well, part of the problem right now is kind of a, even in those scientists that have, you know, rejected those ignorant superstitions of, you know, believing in God and the Bible and stuff like that, what do they end up doing? They end up just producing basically the exact same silly notion that the religionists created about, you know, when everything began. You know, they came up with 4004 BC. You know, the religionists did. The scientists come up with 13.75 billion. I mean, there's no difference between those two. I mean, relative to, you know, hundreds of trillions of years, okay, those are both zero, okay? Those are both ridiculously stupid numbers, okay? Okay. So, yeah. So the irony, you know, in this effort to leave behind 4004 BC and to endlessly mock it, you just turn right around and say, well, it wasn't 4004. That's stupid. It was 4005 BC. You know, I mean, that's about what they've done. That's about all they've done, okay? It's still just totally stupid. It's completely illogical. Yeah, it shouldn't be so hard. It's not stupid. It's extremely sophisticated intellectually, all kinds of fancy mathematics, but it's ridiculously ignorant. I mean, it's so clearly illogical that the age of the Earth can't be on the same order as the age of the universe. That's just illogical. I mean, just look at it. I mean, you know, but they go, well, yeah, but you can't trust your intuition like that. It's like, yeah, yes, you can. Okay, we're children of God. We're given that intuition by God. Okay, but anyway, so yeah, when, you know, years ago when I first was reading the book, when I read that, I just stopped and I just like I couldn't believe it. It's like, you really? That's all there is to it. All the time I spent trying to understand, you know, exponential expansion and inflationary cosmology and all this, it's all just drivel. But just think about that. You know, back when I was first thinking about it, we didn't have the dark energy thing. Okay? And so, I saw the midpoint thing, and was chuckling. Yeah, now you can, in expanding phase too, see? The whole dark energy thing too is a second chuckle that you can add to it. Okay. I mean, but, it's not all about just being able to ridicule the primitive thinking of current science. It's fun, to poke fun at it, but just notice that's what the revelation is about. Okay. The revelation is about a better set of initial assumptions. If you take some non-God-centered initial assumption and you just go with trying to extrapolate what you see right now, they're trying to point out how ridiculous the conclusions are that you reach, and that your enlightenment should allow you to see the illogic of those conclusions. You should go, wait a minute, reductio ad absurdum. That's absurd that the universe is 13.75 billion years old. It doesn't matter if the mathematics says that. That's absurd. I obviously have a false initial assumption. Wouldn't it be wonderful if somehow I could find a better set of initial assumptions? Okay. Yeah. That's Chris Halverson speaking, a few years back. And he found a better set. Right? Okay. You can't find them until you ask for them. You have to get to the point where you're not satisfied with 13.75 billion and inflationary cosmology and quarks and dark energy and Higgs bosons and on it goes. You're not satisfied with that anymore. It's foolish. It's obviously foolish. And you want something better. And as soon as you want something better, the revelators can answer the angels can answer your question right now very immediately because of what the revelators did for us. Within minutes, you could have this book hit you on the head. Okay? Fall off a shelf onto you. Whatever, yeah. We all know the stories. Okay, it's right here. What you could ask for is so immediately accessible now. and if you go, well, it involves primary, force organizers and Frandalanx, and yeah, just try it though. Yours involves quarks. Okay. Okay. It's like, yeah, but that's a very, where did you get the name? You took the most frivolous book that you could think of and pulled a name out for it. You use the word big, the name Big Bang for your theory of everything, which was a ridicule term coined by Hoyle. You like purposely take on derision. Deep down, you know this is ridiculous. Okay? Frandalank may be a weird sounding name, but it's causal. Your names are acausal, which is better. Okay? You have got to get to the point where you're not satisfied, and you're willing to give it a shot. It's like, well, let me try this. And if you actually try starting with these assumptions and see what they imply, you make an amazing discovery. These assumptions work, and they're easy. It doesn't involve any advanced mathematics to understand why it appears flat or why, it appears that there's some dark energy driving everything outward. It's actually just self-evidently straightforward.
Well, except they tell us they don't understand.
Right, we don't know why. But of course, they already should know that. They used to know that, and then they rejected that knowing. They converted the cosmology from metaphysics into physics. And when they did that, they knew what they were doing. They knew that they were doing the absurd. They knew that they were presuming that somehow we could deduce the nature of the whole by looking at a part.
Which they are you talking about? Scientists?
Scientists. Scientists. Okay? I mean, if you know there's a God, if you have a if you're making a true effort at metaphysics, you know there's a God, and you know that that God, if that God does anything, that God is going to dominate the whole. You can't neglect the influence of God on the entire universe. That would be a false assumption. It's likely to be 99.999999% of what's going on is inscrutable because it's in the hands of God. It's not just 73% or 95%. Okay, you know the revelators know that too. They know that's it's. I mean, God has a hold of that. You can't know that. We used to have enough philosophical integrity to know that too, that there's no way you could presume to know the nature of the whole. But you can zero in, and it's like, well, if I get down to a region of space that's just this small, I can probably, usually, neglect the influence of mind, of beings, of God, of deity, and just assume that what I see is what I have. So let me try that. It's like, oh, I got the right answer. Okay, so it must be a reasonable assumption. If I just look at what's there, calculate what it implies, I get exactly the behavior that I see. So it must have been a reasonable assumption to neglect the influence of mind and God, you know, God and whatnot on that little circumscribed system. That's one of the fundamental assumptions of science, that you're finding a region of physical stuff where you can neglect mind, the influence of mind. You know, if I'm trying to understand the movement of my arm right now, it's impossible to understand the movement of my arm if I neglect mind. You know, I'm going to have to invent a magical dark force acting in the universe that causes an oscillating influence upon the molecules in my arm and makes it go up and down. Like, no, it has nothing to do with a dark force. Okay, it has to do with my mind telling my arm to go up and down. Okay, you can't neglect mind. You know, in thinking about the motion of my arm.
And your mind, not somebody else's okay. mind.
but I can study, you know, this cup falling. Once I let go of it, I can't, you know, moving the cup up, I can't neglect mind. But after I let go of it, I can neglect mind and get the exact answer of the acceleration, how long it takes and all that sort of stuff. Okay. I can neglect mind when studying that system. Okay. That used to be recognized, you know, that you had to find something that had a boundary condition where you could neglect God in the equation, because you can't put God in the equation. He's inscrutable. You don't know if, you know, if it's, is it 2x or 3x? You don't know. You don't even know if it's x. You don't know anything, okay? So, I mean, we used to know that that was absurd to think that you could somehow look at the behavior of cups and deduce the nature of the entire universe, explain why it's expanding. We knew that was illogical, okay? But we said, no, there is no God, and there is no logic. And so your whole notion of a connection between God and logical is all just, you know, silly. You're a superstitious, you know, primitive. There is no God, so I can measure what's going on here, and I can extrapolate it, and I can deduce the behavior of the whole. No, what you can do is you can measure right here, and you can rationalize. You can rationalize anything. You can take what you measure in a little bit of space, and you can rationalize it to explain the whole picture.
But it's a lie. Rational lies.
It doesn't mean anything. Yeah. Okay. If we still had a recognition of logic and a genuine philosophy, there would be no roadblock to engaging the revelation. But it's sad to record that most people have, you know, have thrown that out. And so there's none so blind as those who will not see. It's not like it was 2,000 years ago during that spiritual quickening when many people's eyes were opened because of that spiritual quickening. And Jesus and the apostles could speak and be seen by those open eyes. Now, it's sad to record that most eyes are willfully closed. And it doesn't matter that there's a book that you can lay in your lap like this that gives you everything that you're looking for. Your eyes are closed. All right. Now let's move on to some of the more details of the real cosmology, and we'll see that we get the other analogy. We get the Maltese cross analogy now.
Section 7: Space functions of paradise. Space does not exist on any of the surfaces of paradise. If one looked directly up from the upper surface of paradise, one would see nothing but unpervaded space going out or coming in, just now coming in. Space does not touch paradise. Only the quiescent mid-space zones come in contact with the central aisle. Paradise is the actually motionless nucleus of the relatively quiescent zones existing between pervaded and unpervaded space. Geographically, these zones appear to be a relative extension of paradise, but there probably is some motion in them. We know very little about them, but we observe that these zones of lessened space motion separate pervaded and unpervaded space. Similar zones once existed between the levels of pervaded space, but these are now less quiescent. The vertical cross-section of total space would slightly resemble a Maltese cross, with the horizontal arms representing pervaded universe space and the vertical arms representing unpervaded reservoir space. The areas between the four arms would separate them somewhat as the mid-space zones separate pervaded and unpervaded space. These quiescent mid-space zones grow larger and larger at greater and greater distances from paradise and eventually encompass the borders of all space and completely encapsulate both the space reservoirs and the entire horizontal extension of pervaded space.
Okay, so in that one, you know, we take the basic, four triangles of a Maltese cross, you know, at right angles, each other. And, you know, if you want the full picture rather than the cross section, like they're saying, you know, which is the Maltese cross, you know, you just grab it in the center of the two triangles that are pointed up and down and rotate it like this, you know, about that vertical axis. And then, you know, then you get those, the triangles that are horizontal sweep out this big, you know, wedge of pervaded space and the triangles above and below, you know, sweep out little cones. Okay, and so, you know, like they say, it's slightly resemble. I mean, it's not going to have probably stick straight lines like the Maltese cross and all this sort of stuff. And it also, you can't let the four triangles come together at the center. You got to pull them up and down and left and right so that there's a hole in the middle where the aisle can be. And there can be mid-space all around the aisle and in between, you know, around the cones and above and below the big flaring wedge, you know, in the horizontal space, okay? And, like they're saying, you know, not only going out, you know, above and below the big wedge of horizontal space, but eventually wrapping around the end of it, clear out beyond the fourth outer space level, and going up around all sides of the cones and eventually wrapping around the top and bottom of both cones, you know, and, you know, just, you know, eventually you think of it, there's just this bubble around the whole thing, you know, and maybe even, you know, just grading off to infinity, okay? This is a, you know, in terms of thinking about out where we are, this is a really good analogy that has a lot of direct literalness to it. It's when you're thinking about the mechanics right there at the aisle that you sometimes need a different analogy like we had in the previous section, see? Okay. Because in this one, you have no overlap of pervaded and unpervaded space and anything like that to work with to directly understand that whole transmuting thing. The force organizers. But, if you set that aside, then you've got this nice picture where you have mid-space very naturally, like they're saying, where did they say that? Geographically, these zones appear. So you have this nice literal geometry, this geography of the mid-space zones wrapping around and being in between. Okay, so it's a very nice direct picture. It has a lot of truth to it in terms of the structure out here. Now, one thing to just throw in there. Notice how they use the expression total space. So, we have unpervaded space, we have pervaded space, we have mid-space. Okay, we can just ball that all together. We have total space. Or even take it one notch further. Like I was kind of doing as we imagined going out and wrapping around the whole structure of pervaded and unpervaded space and, just extending on out and gradating off to some background level, sort of the foundation of all space, the foundation of total space, okay? There's stuff that's sort of augmented, built up on top of that, but that foundation that you are picturing underlying all of this, it's that foundation of total space that is tied to that zone around the zone of infinity on Nether Paradise, that source region for space. It's not these augmentations, but that background, directly static fact that's the foundation that underlies total space is obviously rooted in the co-absoluteness of that region around the zone of infinity, where you have co-infinite, surrounded by co-absolute, surrounded by absonite. Okay? So, they're really good at when you want to start talking about this stuff and you'd like to have phrases for different parts of the picture, if you look closely, usually they have, they'll say, well, call that total space. Things like that, like total deity, that will actually give you a phrase. You don't have to coin one, and then just, start using it now beyond the one sentence a lot of times that it's used in the book. Start using it as a general way to talk about and tell more of the story.
Yeah, they say there that, space doesn't actually touch paradise. No part.
No, pervaded and unpervaded don't. In this picture, mid-space does. The whole point is the aisle is static. The only thing that can actually touch the aisle has to be quiescence. Okay? The lack of activity. Only the lack of activity can touch the aisle.
It's quiet.
Quiescence. Okay?
How does anything ever approach the aisle?
Yeah, well, we talked about that. That's also where the whole bit about getting a transport, in there. We talked about the hourglass analogy works much better for understanding that. It's by stages, that you slowly work your way to it, from pervaded space to unpervaded space to mid space, and then actually to the aisle. Yeah.
It says that mid space zones eventually completely encapsulate.
Mm-hmm.
And that immediately brings to mind, Big Bubble, and maybe there are other.
That would require another aisle, another first source and center. Whoops, that doesn't work. There's only one first source and center. Yeah. Remember, that's the thing. Remember, in the beginning was the I Am. We're talking about one infinite fact. There's one infinity, the reality of that I Am concept. And there's one center of that infinity, the aisle. There are no parallel universes or multiverses, you know, separate bubbles, like, you know, current theories like to imagine multiple bubbles, okay? No, there's just one bubble. It's like, well, why couldn't there be more? Because then you couldn't have a first source and center, and the universe couldn't be logical, and there couldn't be one bubble, let alone many bubbles.
Chris, I still don't understand. Space does not, I don't even understand that sentence. How can I think that space does not exist on any of the, I mean, space is right here.
Right. But you can't walk through this stuff and get to the aisle. I mean, the thing to recognize is we think of space as being the absence of something. But it's not. It's just that it's so incredibly transcendent of everything that it seems like it's nothing. Remember, we were talking about that last week. The whole point is the literalness of space as a fact is co-absolute. It's completely transcendent of all finite, all supreme, all absonite, all ultimate. Okay? It is completely transcendent of anything that you could think of as a substance. Hence, it's completely valid in all physical theories to just assume that it's just an extension, that it's not a substance, you know, and it, you know, so it can't be curved and all this sort of stuff. But actually, it is a fact. It's a literal thing. There is its presence, and there's domains where it isn't present. You're actually moving through a fact. I mean, a rarefied substance. As I walk through space, I'm walking through a substance, as it were. You know, there is a measure of truth to that static ether notion, you know, of 100 years ago. Only it's a lot more rarefied and transcendent than any ether notion. It's even more rarefied than the notion of space potency. Space is antecedent to space potency, obviously. Because space potency has that adjective in it. So, I mean, space has to be antecedent to space potency. Yeah, right. So, it's a literal fact. And see, it comes from the aisle, but it's not the aisle, and the aisle is not in it. I mean, just think about, I mean, if I manifest something, I put something out here, okay, I'm here, and what I manifested is over there. That's what the aisle did. The aisle burped out space, to be crude about it. So what it manifested is over here, and it's not over there. It's over here. I mean, it's outside of that stuff. And we can walk around in that stuff. We can't walk outside of that stuff. I mean, if you try to send a photon out of that, it can't. A photon has to be within that stuff.
It relies on space.
Right.
Did you mean to say the first source and center?
No, I mean, I was speaking in general there. We were saying we have the first source and center.
Right.
And we're wondering, well, could we have multiple first sources and centers? You know, okay, once you do that, then you're saying, well, there is a first source and center, there is a first source and center, there is a first source and center. It's like, wait a minute, that's illogical. There can't be multiple first sources and centers.
I've never seen one the second church of God.
That's the whole point. The whole point is saying, going from the definite to the indefinite article, from the to a, is to make the point. If you try to do that, that's illogical. There can be only one first source and center of all things and beings. There could be not first source and centers of some things and beings. There can be only one first source and center of all things and beings. You know, if there were multiple bubbles, you know, if the geometry somehow had that, had a structure like that, there would still be a first source and center of all bubbles. One first source and center. There couldn't be multiple first source and centers in each bubble.
So yeah. Is it just like a force? That's what it is? It's a force and it doesn't... Like, I'm taking up this space right here, and because I'm a material person.
See, the space is not just around you. It's also through you.
Yeah, it goes through you.
That's the thing, see? And you can only be... You know, you can't be where there isn't space through you. See, you can't go outside of space. But the Isle of Paradise is outside of space. It doesn't need space through it. It has paradiseness through it. See? I mean, you can just start with a very simplistic viewpoint. You know, like she was just pointing out, it literally says encompassed here. So just imagine, you know, that there's a bubble, you know, that you can move around in. Okay? And that's fine. It's like, well, I can imagine there's a wall, so I can't go outside the bubble. I can understand that. But guess what? There's also a little tiny bubble down in the center of this big bubble. See, so if I try to go towards the center, I hit a wall too. Just like the wall I hit on the outside. There's a tiny little bubble in the center of this great big bubble that I can move around in. It's outside of the space that I can, that the aisle is inside that little bubble in the middle. That's where the aisle is. And it's illusion. When we get down, it's like, well, I actually can get all, I mean, I think I can actually touch my fingers across the center. I mean, if there's something there, it's so tiny, I can't feel it. Yeah, well, that's just, see, that you can't actually see that little bubble. You can't see a surface. So you just extrapolate your perspective just, you know, extrapolates to a zero volume. And, you know, and it's more than a perspective. It's actually an experience. You can't experience anything there. But if you actually can transcend space, presence, you go, whoa. There's like an infinite volume in what I thought was nothing. If I go outside of this bubble, which is really big, but I actually can begin to recognize that it's not infinite, you know. The fourth outer space level is not an infinite distance away. It actually has a volume here. It's not infinite. But when I go outside of that, the volume I'm in, where paradise actually is, does extend all the way to infinity. Outside and around the bubble that I'm in. Okay. And that the Maltese cross picture actually allows you to kind of just directly picture that. You're kind of thinking this mid-space. See, I can look from paradise, you know, in sort of the space that paradise is in, you know, right past all the places where I might be. And then I have a view that just goes all the way out to infinity.
Oh, wow.
See? But inside pervaded space, my view stops just a little past the fourth outer space level. I can't see to infinity. Okay. If I try to send a photon, it'll wrap around and come back. Okay. It can't get outside of the bubble. It's like, you know, it's like walking on the surface of the earth. You walk far enough, you come back around to the point where you're on. Yeah, you're in a closed volume.
Mind and spirit operates in space, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. There has to be a womb of space in which, you know, you're functioning when you're plugged into mind. There's a spirit presence that ends at the boundaries of the local universe. There's a mind presence that ends at the boundaries of the local universe. To go outside of that, either mindily or spiritually, you have to have something that can plug in to a bigger volume. That mind and spirit energy fill every nook and cranny of this whole volume I'm in.
Just like they gave us limitations of mind.
Yeah. So if I could see mind, I mean, I could really see it very definitively. The view would go opaque. You know, it'd be like the room was filled with a fog, you know, and I couldn't see the wall. You know, if I could see the mind energy and the spirit energy, I couldn't see the wall over there because, you know, there's all this mind and spirit energy between me and the wall. Yeah, I couldn't see the wall through all that. Okay.
You could see the pervade,
If you could see the pervasiveness of what pervades, yeah. Okay. Let's see. Okay, so, all right, so that's the basic Maltese cross picture, and we kind of played with it a little bit, see why it's a useful picture. We're talking about out here stuff. And the hourglass is good for talking about the in there close stuff. Okay.
Space is neither a sub-absolute condition within nor the presence of the unqualified absolute. Neither is it a function of the ultimate. It is a bestowal of paradise. And the space of the grand universe and that of all outer regions is believed to be actually pervaded by the ancestral space potency of the unqualified absolute. From near approach to peripheral paradise, this pervaded space extends horizontally outward through the fourth space level and beyond the periphery of the master universe, but how far beyond we do not know. If you imagine a finite but inconceivably large V-shaped plane situated at right angles to both the upper and lower surfaces of paradise, with its point nearly tangent to peripheral paradise, and then visualize this plane in an elliptical revolution about paradise, its revolution would roughly outline the volume of pervaded space.
Okay, so let's just do that. Okay, so here, my left hand is the aisle. You know, it's nice and elliptical and flat. Okay. Okay, and here, if I can do this. It's hard to hold my hand at a side like that and do that. Okay. Okay, so here's a V. Use your imagination. Okay, here's the V they're talking about at right angles to the pancake of paradise here. Okay. Okay. I'm going to sweep it around like this. Okay. You know, it's going to sweep out this big wedge-shaped volume. See, all the way around. Yeah, that's all they're saying. Okay, so that's just, you know, again, it's the Maltese cross picture. You know, you've got those triangles, those Vs of the Maltese cross, and you sweep them around, okay, you know, if you rotate the cross. Okay, but now, you know, notice they're giving you a little bit more of the physics of space there. And basically, they're stating some of the things I've already been saying because I know this sentence was in here. Okay. See, space is neither a sub-absolute condition within nor the presence of the unqualified absolute. Like we were just saying, I mean, the presence of the unqualified absolute is space potency. It's a potential that's in space. So space is obviously antecedent to the fact of what's pervading it. Now, this presence is pervading it. Okay, we do know that space is not absolute. It's co-absolute. It's sub-absolute. Okay, so it's obviously not a function of the ultimate either. It's trans-ultimate, but sub-absolute. It's co-absolute. Okay, and here is that spot. See where it says it directly. What we were pulling out of the nether paradise thing about that region, that area around the zone of infinity. It says right here that space is a bestowal of paradise. The paradise source and center, one of the things that it's a source for is space. Not pervaded space or unpervaded space or even mid-space, but the foundation underneath all of those augmentations, like I was saying, okay? The foundation of total space. Whatever, yeah. It's unqualified space or something, yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's you know, it is a bestowal of paradise. Paradise is the source for it, okay? And so, I mean, it's just a simple thing. You know, they tell you what's going on in every region except one. And they tell you that paradise is the source for space. I mean, it's not too difficult to connect the dots. You know, where does space come from? It doesn't come from the outer region on another paradise. It doesn't come from the central region. It comes from the unnamed area around the presence of the co-infinite one. Okay, around the zone of infinity. All right. Let's see. So, yeah, you with them?
Bile is an absolute fact.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
The unqualified absolute
is also an absolute fact. Yep.
But if you look at it from the unity, it's an infinite.
Right. Yeah. Same, yeah. So. All this stuff, see, all the literalness of the unqualified absolute as absolute is obviously antecedent to any co-absolute or absonite or finite presence. I didn't want to get into a lot of those details. That, they actually start to bring that stuff up in paper 42 when you start to really get into physics, and we don't want to get too off in the weeds on it. But yeah, I mean, you just start knowing, you know, once you start getting some things put in their spots, you start to notice some of these finer details, like, oh, yeah, it is the unqualified absolute, not the co-absolute, and the aisle is not co-absolutum, it's absolutum, and, yeah, see, so, you, oh, I've got some more details I've got to sort out. Yeah, there's a lot of... of greater details that you need to sort out. Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, like what's the presence of the unqualified absolute in midspace? Or beyond midspace? I mean, you see, there's all these questions that you can start to talk about. See. Okay.
There is an upper and a lower limit to horizontal space with reference to any given location in the universes. If one could move far enough at right angles to the plane of Arvanton, either up or down, eventually the upper or lower limit of pervaded space would be encountered. Within the known dimensions of the Master Universe, these limits draw farther and farther apart at greater and greater distances from paradise. Space thickens, and it thickens somewhat faster than does the plane of creation.
Because oh, I'm sorry, yeah, I jumped ahead of you there. They've given you a couple little details here now. You have three of them, basically. And they're talking about those mid-space zones. You know, they've reminded you, don't think of them as some parallel slab of thickness. You know, it's flaring out. It's getting thicker and thicker the farther away from paradise you get. And you've got a similar thing going on here. So if you're thinking about going vertically up, in pervaded space, eventually you're going to hit the top. You know, you're going to hit the ceiling here of this big flaring disk. Okay, notice how they tell you there's some transition here. You've got a region that's closer to the horizontal here, where you have the power and the energy and the force, but then it's starting to really kind of gradate off and see this whole bit about the plane of creation of the universe, i.e. where there's force and energy and power. You know, that's starting to grade off, and you're just going to have this space potency, towards the margins. And see, this thickens somewhat faster. So the farther you get out, the bigger that transition region, the thicker that transition region gets. You know, so that you get way out in the fourth outer space level and you can go vertically like that. You know, there's going to be this vast region where you're really beyond where there's a lot of energy activity and stuff happening, and it's just this kind of no man's land that's, grading off into midspace finally above it. Okay? So that's kind of an interesting little point that they're trying to get you to not think too simplistically. Like, it's literally like a glass vessel that someone blew, a glass blower blew, and I'm inside of the glass vessel, and I try to fly up and tink, I hit the wall, okay? What'll happen is if I try to take that imaginary journey, I'll find that I just, no matter how much I, pull back on the throttle, I'm just going to, because I'm running out of something to sort of you know, how do you want to think about it? Maybe, you know, if I'm going to move, if I'm going to move on a road, I have to be able to grab the road and push, you know, myself along. I have to have some sort of like friction sort of. I have to, I mean, you know, you're grinding to a halt. You know, it doesn't matter if you're a photon or what you are. You just won't be able to move because there's no way for you to be passing through what you need. You know, it's like if you're imagining something sort of being ingested and injected out the back. You know, there's nothing to bring in, you know, to the jet engine anymore and push out the back. And so you just grind to a halt, just like a jet engine does if it runs out of air, right? Okay. You're running out of pervaded space, and you just won't, you know. Now, so, and so it actually just gradates off into mid-space. And you have, like I said, it used to be that mid-space that's going up in between used to come down in between the levels, too, see? Yeah, it used to. But now it's not as quiescent. See, and so, like I was saying, see, it's like that everywhere. There's gradations. You know, so as I go, in other words, if I go from the super universe level out to the first outer space level, the pervaded space will get thinner and thinner, and it'll reach a minimum, and then it'll start to get thicker and thicker again. Well, it used to be it went to zero. So in other words, if there was a photon out in the second outer space level, it couldn't even have gotten to the super universe level. I couldn't have seen anything out there. But now there's something that the photon can, you know, we can see the Andromeda galaxy, for instance, okay? Photons from it actually make it through that not as quiescent zone now. But it is still definitely different than pervaded space. They may be affected by this. I mean, do they like get energy sucked out of them, for instance, as they pass through that and then can pick up again? Or what? I mean, I don't know. We'd have to figure out the physics of this. I mean, but there may be all kinds of distortions to our view of things. When we look at galaxies out in the second outer space level, those photons had to get through the gap between the second and first, and then between the gap between the first and the super universe. Okay, they could have been modified.
Are you saying that Andromeda is on the first outer space level?
It's right on the inside edge of the first outer space level. Yeah, it's uninhabited. I mean, they tell you that point blank. And they just tell you in the book. Okay. We can still see it because it's not as quiescent between the levels as it used to be. Just one thing I want to bring in with what, let's see, now I forgot. See, the first, oh yeah, yeah. The other thing to keep in mind here, now we have this V's and Maltese crossing, okay, this whole picture and thinking about flying up and hitting the boundaries and mid-space regions and all this. Okay, remember now, there's going to be no way to actually literally see this structure clearly because the photons, for instance, if I'm here, let's actually so this is the central universe, this big circular table here, and I'm over in the seventh super universe over here, and you're over there in, say, the third super universe. Now, beyond you is the first outer space level, and beyond that, there's second outer space level. Okay, but, you know, and remember, it's flaring up, and so, you know, if I visualize this picture, way off in the distance over your head, far off in the distance, there's a galaxy way out in the second outer space level, clear over there on the other side of the central universe. It's like, well, okay, so I can imagine a photon coming right straight to me from that. It's like, well, there is no such straight path, you know, because right in here is unpervaded space and mid-space all around it. That photon can't take a straight line path and get to me, okay? But it's not like I'm not going to get that photon. I mean, that photon is going to start to come straight this way, and then it's going to curve around all this unpervadable, you know, stuff here. And finally going to come down like this. So let's say maybe, you know, it comes down like this. Okay, so I see this photon coming into my telescope from up like this. I go, well, okay, so that must be a galaxy that's right there. I follow it, you know, I assume it went a straight line path. I follow it back. So I think that cluster of galaxies or that galaxy is up there. No, it's over there. See, so when we actually look, it looks like there's galaxies all around us. Because a whole bunch of these, we think they're straight up like this. No, there isn't anything straight up like that. Yeah, right. They're just being, they're not following straight line paths. They're being bent around all of this stuff in between. And see, so it's a very distorted picture we have. You know, we're down in a swimming pool, and seeing, things all goofed up. Okay.
Less than 100 years of knowledge, because in 1912, we only knew of one galaxy, the Milky Way.
So, all this disease is just so new, and we have no concept of just how incredibly distorted this picture is because of this Maltese cross structure we're talking about here. Because it isn't the same in every direction, photons take all sorts of circuitous paths, and we're not going to know that. This isn't going to be like seeing a lensing effect, they're not going to be distorted. Just all the photons are going to be, they're going to be following a nice rectilinear path, but, it's like they're going through a fiber optic, cable, that's bent around. See? Yep.
But we can see a galaxy that's a billion light years away, can we not?
Mm-hmm. Actually, there aren't any. Those are distortions. The farthest galaxies are a few hundred million light years away. The ones that they think are farther than that, that's a distortion, too. And we don't want to go into that yet, but... okay. There are no galaxies. To see a galaxy a billion light years away, there would have to be galaxies in the third outer space level, and there aren't. There's only galaxies in the second outer space level.
Distances are...
Yeah. Right. Billions of light years puts you out in the third outer space level, and aren't any galaxies out there yet. They tell you that.
Okay.
I won't explain to you how you deduce that or anything, but... all right. Let's wrap this up. So, notice what I'm doing. See, once you have this picture, this is a valid analogy. So I'm applying it, and immediately is telling me in a whole bunch of things, whoa, this is really going to be messed up. When I look at the Hercules supercluster and it's up there, I go, isn't that a violation of the revelation? No, I got to remember it's probably over there in the second outer space level. And it just looks like it's up there. All right.
You get a signal from a fiber optic.
But I can look to the Virgo supercluster in the first outer space level, okay, and that's a pretty undistorted view. It's just pretty straightforward, But
the relatively quiet zones between the space levels, such as the one separating the seven super universes from the first outer space level, are enormous elliptical regions of quiescent space activities. These zones separate the vast galaxies which race around paradise in orderly procession. You may visualize the first outer space level, where untold universes are now in process of formation, as a vast procession of galaxies swinging around paradise, bounded upon above and below by the mid-space zones of quiescence, and bounded on the inner and outer margins by relatively quiet space zones.
It's a big donut of space. Okay? A donut-shaped region, a toroidal, a donut-shaped region all the way around.
A space level thus functions as an elliptical region of motion, surrounded on all sides by relative motionlessness. Such relationships of motion and quiescence constitute a curved space path of lessened resistance to motion, which is universally followed by cosmic force and emergent energy as they circle forever around the Isle of Paradise.
Just take a simple thing. Take our test particle, take something we know about, take a photon, okay? It's, you try to shine a flashlight straight up, okay? And it's not just going to go straight up forever, okay? Eventually, it's going to meet resistance and be bent around. You know, eventually, it's going to end up going around, you know, not only because that's where pervaded space is, so that's where it can actually go, but there's also a flow that it's caught up in. You know, if I imagine a galaxy out there in the middle of the first outer space level, like they're saying here, and it's giving off light, and I imagine those, again, you know, here. So here's the central universe, and out here, I'm out here in this first outer space level, I'm a galaxy, that's just me. Okay, so I'm a galaxy, and I'm trying to shine my light radially inward, okay, to the stuff around the central universe here, like Orvinton, okay, where there's guys with telescopes, okay? And, you know, so I send my photon radially inward, okay? Well, there's a problem here. I mean, this is not motionless. You know, there's a flow here. So that photon doesn't go straight radially. It drifts. Because there's a clockwise motion in the first outer space level. So it drifts this way as it goes radially inward.
Which is probably why our astronomers think that the Milky Way and Andromeda are one day on a collision course.
Well, I mean, the fact that, yeah, we're across, that's why it appears that the two of them are moving towards each other. But they're really ships passing in the night.
Right.
Yeah. Right. You know, so that photon drifts this way, and then it goes through the quiescent zone, and then it gets in the super universe level, and then it drifts this way a little bit, and then finally it lands on a telescope somewhere. See? Okay, yeah. So yeah, those flows are moving it too. You know, every ultimaton is in that flow. Yeah. So a photon, they're all flowing. Yeah.
This alternate zoning of the master universe, in association with the alternate clockwise and counterclockwise flow of the galaxies, is a factor in the stabilization of physical gravity designed to prevent the accentuation of gravity pressure to the point of disruptive and dispersive activities. Such an arrangement exerts anti-gravity influence and acts as a brake upon otherwise dangerous velocities. Mm-hmm.
Just take a simple example, the one that she was just thinking of. So, if there wasn't a counterclockwise flow in the superuniverse level, so that the Milky Way galaxy is going that way, and there wasn't a clockwise flow in the first outer space level, so the Andromeda galaxy wasn't going that way. If they really were just right next to each other like this, you know, they're two giant masses. They'll be drawn towards each other. They'll intermesh and fling their stars all over the place. Okay, but that's not going to happen. I mean, even if you imagined, you know, them crossing the quiescent zone and all that, I mean, before they can move close to each other, they move apart and the gravity weakens and, yeah. So, see, that's what they're talking, you know, that's the simplest way to think about what they're talking about. You know, before they could possibly move radially upon each other, their ships would have passed in the night.
All these colliding galaxies that they think they see out there.
Well, they do. I mean, you know, you go out in the second outer space level, and you do have galaxies. So, you know, what this whole bit about disruptive and dispersive, imagine if one of those colliding galaxies we see out there was the Milky Way galaxy, which was inhabited. Okay, what happens? You know, two galaxies, two big spiral galaxies come together. Now, no two stars actually plow into each other because they're very far, you know, but they you know, interleave themselves, you know, and gravity, slingshot effect, I mean, the stars all just go flinging off, you know, you get these big tails of stars, you know, okay, creates all the, you know, it would just totally disrupt all the work that the master physical controllers and the supreme power centers have been doing to dot all the I's and cross all the T's in the Milky Way galaxy, okay? And obviously, you know, there's a very mysterious thing. The Revelators is even mysterious to the Revelators, what's going on out there. You take this big, beautiful spiral galaxy that's like the seven, you know, in the super universe level, and everyone's going, ah, look at those big, beautiful. They're just like our seven. And then they watch, what? They watch them plow into each other and just... and then, of course, over, you know, trillions of years, they watch them slowly, you know, pool together into big giant elliptical blobs, you know, and all the beauty of the big spirals are gone, and it's just this big ugly blob of stars, and they're going, what is going on out there? See, whatever is going on is way in the early stages of formation.
One of the things that I love to imagine, because you see pictures of these absolutely gorgeous clusters, but they have no shape. It's just a bazillion stars. And you can imagine some force coming in and just going into a spiral.
Now, of course, one of the really interesting things to think about when you got two big spirals passing through each other like that, remember there's an associate transcendental master force organizers resident in each of those whirls. It must be an interesting ride for them. Yeah. I'm not sure how that all works. Yeah. You know.
They position themselves down the top and on the bottom and they move things.
Right. You know, and so how do you know how well no that's but that's you know that's just the primary ones spinning up the whirl. You know, like the Andromeda Galaxy, okay? The primary spun up that world, and then the secondaries, you know, took up residence there, and are still there. You look at the Andromeda Galaxy, you're looking at the presence of associate force organizers. They live there. There's some, you know, and, you know, so you've got this, you know, because their presence is slowly distilling the world into automatons, and then, in, you know, making stars out of the automatons, okay? So, you know, so you look at the giant elliptical galaxy as the center of the Virgo cluster, say. Okay, that used to be a whole bunch of spirals with force organizers. You know, it's like, well, now are they like a pool of force organizers in a big spherical blob now? Or, I mean, I don't know. You know, you don't even know what to think about this stuff.
You have to learn how to dance.
All right. It's all very mysterious.
And that group of galaxies they call Able.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, there's a number of those. Right, there's clusters and superclusters. Right. So when you're talking about big things like that, you know, you're out in the second outer space level. Okay, so anyway, that last paragraph sounds kind of mysterious and whatnot. But, you know, the basics is very, you can understand. Yeah, if there are ships passing in the night, there's no way they're going to.
At least they don't have level to level problems.
Right.
Within a level,
right. There's. Right, but of course that's, you know, it's fine for there to be things going on in this first and second because it's not being managed yet, you know. But in terms of us and the effect that this first outer space level could have on us, we're shielded by the counter rotation and the quiescent zone. It keeps the first outer space level from, you know, making havoc out of this slowly crystallizing perfection of the seven super universes.
No commingling of the
level. Okay. You know, and eventually it can all settle into a perfect eternal state like the central universe, and it will not be disrupted by all of the stuff that's going to go on. Yeah, this is all taken into account. All right. So we'll just keep chugging along with a little bit more about Paradise Gravity the next time. You'll see it kind of, there's some things, again, along this line about thinking logically about the way things are set up, because there is space and stuff, wow, that also helps to stabilize and buffer things. So we'll get into that a little bit more. Let's take a moment here.